Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Horrible Podcast. I'm Brian.
Sorry, I was waiting for Tyler. I'm Drew.
And feature player?
Lona.
Wow, you'd think we'd never done this before.
We've not done it in that order.
No, we haven't. I guess that was it. You should have seen it last week when it was just me. I was like, I'm Brian. It was basically the same thing just then.
Mine was purposeful, actually. I would have just said it, but I thought it was...
Tyler, fun. Yes, Tyler is out again this week. Apparently, he has hurt his back like an old man. arguably the youngest of all of us, he's staying hurt his
arguably?
Back. Is he older than Lona?
How old is he?
I don't know. Tyler's
age. Terrible
ages.
Friends.
I mean,
is he 30?
I could tell you him, but not. Well, he's 82.
Oh, yes. Then yes, he is.
Yes, he's older than me.
He's older than all of us.
Well,
put together.
No, he's not 82.
Oh, he was born in 82.
Yes.
Oh.
Not 82.
Oh,
that
well,
was
then,
ridiculous.
Then he is younger than
that
me.
Was ridiculous. That was ridiculous. Yeah, so he is the youngest of all of us. With us tonight,
did
we're
really
very.
Think he was 82?
Well, well, no.
Did you really think he was 82?
No,
some
but
of his beliefs and the way he acts.
He's from South Georgia. They grow him old down there. With us tonight is a very special guest who has just had to listen to us rag on one of our friends, Mr. Alex Cuervo. How you doing,
Tyler.
Alex? Yes, he is the brains behind a Spectrostatic. Which has made probably the best John Carpenter album. And also is in a punk band called the Hex Dispensers. I wouldn't be remiss to say very heavily Misfits influenced.
Yeah, that's a fair connection.
And he's also on track to score the new Tom Savini film Nightmare City. Which is still, I guess, I think it's maybe a year or maybe a little more than a year away from seeing light of day. So
probably, I'm guessing they're going to be shooting in the fall and the into the winter.
Gotcha. So what we brought you on today is give us all the details about Nightmare City, all the spoilers. I'm just kidding. No, we brought Alex on today because, for one, Spectrostatic is an amazing group. Even though
pretty awesome. Yeah.
Even though I know the group is technically just you.
Right.
But has some of the best horror film that you won't find in a horror movie, although that's not true because you had a song in the film Interior that we actually just talked about.
Yeah, two songs actually.
There you go. So he actually has been in horror films already.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in reading about John Carpenter's Lost Themes, you were actually brought up in a review I read about how similar it was to Spectrostatic's newest album, which is Escape from Witchopolis, correct?
Witchtropolis.
Yeah, so we're going to say it many times, but if you have not listened to it, please go and do that. We'll give you the Bandcamp address and all that kind of good stuff so Alex can make sure he gets paid for his amazing stuff. So let's start off right off the bat. Your favorite horror film soundtrack? Doesn't have to be a score. It could be the score or the soundtrack to Judgment Night or Last Action Hero.
Well, I guess for score, it would probably be The Fog by John Carpenter.
Nice.
It's my favorite John Carpenter score. And then soundtrack with like just a bunch of music. I don't know, like Return of the Living Dead, maybe.
Wow.
Just.
Yeah, I would say for me, it would probably be Jaws. For a horror soundtrack, and then for All Out, just best soundtrack would probably be Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3 for Dream Warriors, just for Dawkins' song.
Yeah.
It would be my favorite right there. I mean, that's a big winner, of course. So are we just going around the table?
Yeah,
right
go
now?
Ahead.
I always go, it's always hard to steer clear of a John Carpenter, and The Fog's never been one that I particularly latched onto, but it's the same way with the movie. It's not one I dislike. I just never have latched onto that movie as much as some of those. I really like Prince of Darkness is probably my kind of more off the wall, if any John Carpenter is, for my favorite. And then we're picking another one. I would probably just sit there and say just Dream Warriors.
Just the song Dream Warriors.
just Dream Warriors, yeah. You know.
Lona.
You know, I even made notes and I actually wrote The Fog down as one of my favorites.
Were those notes in a paper bag?
Huh? No. It's a legal document because I did it at work legally. But then I also am a huge fan of the original Last House on the Left. I love it.
There you go. Nice. Now, are you talking specifically about the song Weasel and Crew?
Just the folksy
yes.
music?
Well, but it relates. I really like the juxtaposition of it against the film because, you know, it's such a dark movie. And then it's like you're going on a murder spree with the mamas and the papas almost. And I like that.
I think that's what the Manson family did. I think they were attacked. I think the mamas and the papas played prodigiously in their murders.
Yeah, it was all part of their plan. The mamas,
like,
the papas,
played,
and
played
Charlie.
Live while they were performing the murders.
Exactly. You know, and saying Last House on the Left also maybe reminded me of how, not necessarily my favorite score, but Cannibal Holocaust, and how just odd it is for that film. That it's a beautiful score, but it doesn't match up with what's going on screen.
Well, it punctuates so many scenes so well, though. I mean, that's the one thing I think of. Like, I mean, it has a weird haunting quality to it. Like, there's the scene where they're chopping up the sea turtle, like which we know is really happening, of course. And then it's such an odd, I think, musical choice. If I recall that scene correctly, I think I do.
It was it was very very melodic, very what's a good word? Alex, help me out here. What's a good word besides melodic?
I'm actually not really familiar with that score.
Oh no!
Yeah,
okay.
I know it's been reissued recently, but it's not.
The go ahead.
Said haunting at one point. I think it has like kind of that, you know, it has a hauntingness to it.
Yeah,
quality to it, maybe.
The besides John Carpenter's The Fog, we should probably just make this podcast about John Carpenter. If we're gonna,
we should just talk about the bad ones. Let's just name, you know, reel off the ones. Well, I don't like this one.
I don't know if I know of one. They Live. No?
I don't remember it as well. I mean, when you're getting to, like, Ghost of Mars territory, I mean, you're not in a...
Well, we all, I think we can all agree that Halloween, the soundtrack, the score for Halloween is pretty horrible.
What?
No, not at all.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. I actually just watched The Thing with my son for the first time. He's 8 years old, so...
nice.
Yeah, and I realized, like... It's Ennio Morricone is credited with the score for that film.
Right.
But, you know, I guess John Carpenter was also involved. It was...
I think Morricone just pretty much channeled John Carpenter's style. I mean, he really did take his cues from John Carpenter's previous films.
And what I was going to... It's funny you say that because... Well, it's not really funny you say that because as I was listening to it, I thought, wow, this is not like any Morricone score I have ever heard before.
Yeah, it's much more minimal, but it still has a lot of like really nice orchestration, sparsely throughout. It's a cool score because it's kind of understated, you know. It's just kind of creepy and menacing and sparse. But yeah, that's a great score.
I guess we would also be remiss if we didn't mention the kings of Italian horror scores, Goblin.
Yes.
Now, I mentioned to you, if you had seen them on the last tour, you said you did.
Yeah.
Drew and I also got to catch them. It was...
it was great.
It was... it was pretty odd to just see the guys who made all of these scores that, you know, legendary scores, just they're playing it on stage in front of you. Like,
yeah.
This is, you know, you listen to it like, oh, God, this is the song from Profondo Rosso. And,
yeah, I got goosebumps when they played that one.
Yeah. My favorite... my favorite is probably, if it's not Suspiria, it's going to be that, the song is called Zeratazoom from, I think it's either Day or Dawn of the Dead. I cannot remember which film it's from.
I think it is an interesting question real quick to kind of address some of the, you know, some. I mean, you had mentioned the good Carpenter, and then we could go with bad. Like I said, I don't remember Ghost of Mars at all. And if I remember anything, I feel like probably the score was one of the stronger things about it, even though I don't remember it, just because how could it not have been?
Right.
But I remember one that I just never, and again, it was the movie I didn't ever connect with as much either. And I had the soundtrack on CD, bought it as soon as it came out because it was right in the middle of high school when I was into all of that as well.
It was
Vampires as well. And it's bad. It's
kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
It's cool, like from a musical standpoint, but some of the instrumentation, it's real dated. It's real of its time, you know?
Definitely, yeah. Which that movie is as well. I mean, that's another problem. I think that's a problem you run into with almost anything from the early mid 90s. It really feels dated now.
See, the thing about John Carpenter, a lot of it is some of that early stuff. Like, I think it holds up. Like, I think, you know, I think Escape from New York and stuff. Like, I think there's aspects of them that date them, but there's just something about them that, to me, they have more longevity. And then the stuff that came a little bit later was trying to be cooler and was referencing more contemporary stuff, and I think lost some of that. But the reason I like The Fog so much is it's kind of abstract. It's kind of, it's real textural and it's real moody, you know?
Well, let me ask you this. Besides horrors, who are some of your other composers that you're a huge fan of? Not necessarily horror films.
Just in general.
Yeah.
Man, it's a long list.
Let's hear it.
There's, well, I mean, you know, there's the classic composers like Bernard Herrmann and Ennio Morricone. I really like Angelo Badalamenti a lot. Twin Peaks and all the David Lynch stuff. And he's coming back for the new series.
Do you know how I have a funny Angelo Badalamenti story? Was that how much money I paid for the score for the movie The Beach?
Oh wow!
Yeah, apparently they didn't make very many of them. I remember at the time I was like, I think I paid $49 for the CD of that.
Wow.
Jesus.
Yeah. For a CD.
Yeah. It was after the film had come out, and I'd bought the soundtrack, which was full of great pop hits like Sugar Ray and yeah. It was horrible. It had Moby's song, the one that was huge, Porcelain, I think it. Yeah. Porcelain, that one that was in everything for a while there. But I remember being like, I sucked it up. I was like, I'm buying this because this score is amazing. It's an amazing score.
Yeah, Badalamenti is he's a bad motherfucker. There's a really great YouTube video of him talking about coming up with Laura Palmer's theme, and he's playing it on an electric piano while he's being interviewed, and it's a hilarious video. You should see it. He's so like, he gets so worked up emotionally while he's talking about it, kind of in a funny anecdotal way, but it's great. It's really funny and really entertaining. He's a neat guy.
What about I'll tell you, some of my favorites are Thomas Newman.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Thomas Newman fan. Clint Mansell.
Clint Mansell is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably my new, of all the, I still think new in my head, but probably my latest obsession, if there is one, I would guess.
I think the soundtrack to the score to The Fountain is probably one of my it may be my favorite thing.
That's
ever.
A great. I love Moon. Yeah. Also, that's,
Moon is great.
That's an incredible score.
He causes me to have such like emotional responses to his music, though. So
he's awesome.
I remember falling asleep listening to The Fountain, and there's this. The second to the penultimate song on that soundtrack, it gets really quiet, and all of a sudden it blasts you with like this huge chorus and operatic vocals. And I remember,
that's the one. He has Kronos Quartet play on that one.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah,
I was almost asleep when that came through the headphones one night, and I was like, "Oh shit!" So, Luna, what about you?
I don't know. Let's see. Bernard Herrmann, a lot of the old like Hitchcock stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I really liked that. But that was like what I grew up on, and you know, I have like really, I associate things very strongly with memories, and so I would need to go back and actually listen to it now, thinking about it, without just having like the sort of attachment.
Well, Psycho's a horrible soundtrack, so...
No, it's not. It's
I'm joking.
Look.
I'm joking.
You're a crazy person.
Yeah, as I was joking, because that's it's like a, the... Not only the shower scene, but the... not just the... But everything about that soundtrack is great.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really like the Tangerine Dream score for Sorcerer specifically, but they what they do the Keep, they did a lot of
they did Legend, didn't they? Or
yeah,
they're pretty awesome too. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm right.
That's really good. That's really good stuff.
So pretty recently, one of the big kind of, I mean. Talking about disaster piece and It Follows, which I know Alex and I have had a conversation about this before, just over email, about the artist himself isn't a horror fan, but yet yeah. made probably one of the best horror soundtracks of the last probably 10 years.
I think that speaks to more his skill, his musical skill. Mm-hmm. I think he went to Berkeley. Like, he's a really, like, for real, like, music theory dude. And he's mostly does video games, like indie video games and stuff like that. And he's famous for what, Fez?
Fez, yeah,
I guess
that
before
was the,
that. But
Fez
that score is, I think he just had to really follow the temp for the vibes and stuff, you know? And,
right.
And he did a great job. It's an awesome score.
Do you think that when it comes to like horror films, is it... Do you think about it really makes a difference if it's just the movie that makes the difference when it comes to the actual music? Because like a trend for like the late 90s was to have all metal pop kind of soundtrack. Not really pop, but metal heavier soundtrack instead of got away from the score. Do you think it just really depends on the movie if what works best?
It's a weird thing to I don't know. It's up to, because it's kind of the director's guidance, it's up to the director.
Right.
Who they pick, is indicative of how they want to frame it, who they choose as the composer is part of what they're trying to convey stylistically. When you have a licensed song, like a soundtrack, like say Return of the Living Dead, where there's a lot of songs that existed already in the world, I guess they call them needle drops, when they're just, it's like a licensed piece of music.
Right.
And then you have, original score written for the scenes. Original score for me is going to win every time because it's custom built to suit the narrative of that moment that, in that scene. What a really cool way of thinking about it is that when you read a book, the author of the book tells you, what a character is thinking. But in a movie without overdubbed narration, you don't really have that. And that's the function of the music. It's there to kind of like fill in the blanks that you wouldn't get to kind of help guide the narrative,
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
That's a good point. What is the, I'm sorry, Drew, were you going to ask a question? I heard you.
No, I just agreed with that. I thought it was a good point. Like you had said, yeah. I think an interesting question I had, and it's because I had issues with this figuring out deciding on soundtracks, is how much did I even appreciate the idea? It became big in the 90s of just the a collection of sometimes new material, but not necessarily of just pop or rock songs, and that became the soundtrack. When almost it went to the point where you had the two soundtracks released, kind of like you talked about with The Beach, and where I ended up having to buy two soundtracks because or just one soundtrack, the other one sometimes. Well, it just, I don't know, it became such a big thing, and I never decided whether I actually liked it or not.
I
still don't know. I don't know if I do.
The thing that got even more out of hand was the soundtracks they would do of music inspired by the film.
Yes.
That shit that wasn't even in the movie. I can't think of any. I remember seeing a lot of those in the 90s.
Almost every Batman film had one, especially as they got to like Batman and Robin and things of that nature, with like R. Kelly's awful Gotham City.
Where obviously R. Kelly had never seen any Batman film when the line he refers to Gotham City as the City of Justice.
R. Kelly was busy doing other things in the 90s.
So, in I was just looking up the Beach soundtrack. It did have, I remember it being so pissed off when I got the music from the film, because there was an Angelo Badalamenti song on there, but it was with his, like, a remix by Orbital. And I was like, oh, God damn it, this is not what I wanted. But yeah.
It was a weird time. Now it's nice because there's they do, it seems like it's kind of more together. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think that we've gotten back to, well, as horror has kind of come back around and become, probably a lot better than it was in the late 90s, early 2000s. The scores have gotten better as well.
Yeah, there's some really great composers working right now. I mean, that disaster piece score gets a lot of press right now. But I mean, Steve Moore has just been killing it, and Jonathan Snipes, two really talented, kick-ass composers. Steve Moore from Zombie, who did The Guest, and
Right.
He did Cub.
I have not seen Cub yet, but it's on my list of things.
Oh, God, it's so great, and the score is phenomenal. It's really good. It's a total synthesizer score.
Sweet.
And it's you got really, me. Really good.
You got me. And Steve Moore
he was in Zombie. He actually played with, on the last tour of Goblin, he played keyboards with them.
Oh, okay.
He sat in for Simonetti, who was not with them. On the tour that I saw.
So you've kind of sidetracked me, and I'm sitting here looking up all the soundtracks from, like, late 90s horror movies that I went to the movies with my friends and watched. Mm-hmm. Like, I Know What You Did Last Summer and, like, Scream and all those sorts of things. And there's some really bad stuff on these.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and I didn't know at the time, but Kula Shaker. Have you thought about this since 1999?
Wow.
No, I mean, I have not. Like,
just yesterday.
Well, I was looking at the Beach soundtrack, I realized there is a track from the group All Saints, which I was dear God.
Oh, wow, yeah.
There's a Moby song on Scream, so I think he was just really kind of getting all of his
soundtrack
chances he could right then.
Well, let's face it, we're missing a golden opportunity when we talk about music from Scream.
We talk about the rapper, the Scream.
Master P, yeah.
I am coming.
Shocker, yeah. Yes, that would be it.
It got
two,
so bad. It got Drew and I got so bad at watching, like, horrible movies. I bought the Lost in Space score from Drew.
That's good. At least we didn't both buy
you
it.
Bought it, and I was like, oh, I'll pick up on that if you're getting rid of it. And then I was like, why did I buy this? I think I tried
why
to
Why did
trade.
You buy that?
I don't know. For that, wasn't there like...
I think the movie's underrated.
What was the?
I haven't watched it in years.
There was a. It had Gary Oldman in it. But yeah. there was a song in there by someone that, like, they did someone redid the Lost in Space Apollo 440.
And it was a cool sound. It was a cool song.
And the crystal, you know, of course, it was Apollo 440, Crystal Method, Propellerhead, Fatboy Slim, all the amazing bands from the late 90s.
Amazing.
The also Maniac, the remake of Maniac had a pretty amazing soundtrack.
Oh yeah, Rob. A great score. It's really good. I'd never even heard of Rob until that score.
I'm assuming it was Rob Zombie. Am I wrong about that?
For Maniac?
Yeah.
The Elijah Wood remake?
I was joking. Yeah. I know it's not Rob's.
No, it's like a dance electronic artist. I know so little about electronic music.
EDM is my life. Don't know how I go out through a day without it. It's funny mentioning. Well, it's not funny. It's right on schedule with what I was going to ask about. Other than we have horror soundtracks, we have movies that have metal in them. How about bands that are actually influenced by horror? Which is why I kind of mentioned you being in the band that was heavily influenced by the Misfits, because. Seminal to my raising was that my parents listened to Alice Cooper when I was young and Black Sabbath and stuff like that, and that whole everything about that was what appealed to me was, you know, Alice Cooper and his song Dead Babies. My dad always would, a sweet father of mine, who would sing the song Dead Babies to his son. That's what attracted me to why I got into White Zombie in high school, and another big one? Even Marilyn Manson, to a point, it became a what is almost horror music.
There's a huge horror rock genre.
The Misfits being in high school when I first heard Eagles Dare, I was like, I'm addicted to this band now. So
yeah,
and I up to that point, I really didn't like punk. I wasn't a huge, I didn't get into like, I'm drawing a blank on punk, any punk. I did like the Ramones, but that I didn't feel like they were the punk that my friends were into. They weren't, like, when I think of real punk, I think of Sublime.
That's actually the last thing I think of when I think of punk.
No, I'm trying to think of some other, not even, I guess the Descendants and, I had friends that were into, like, there's a group called Skateniggs and stuff like that that they were really into, and they would listen to it nonstop. I was like, I can't listen. This is not the music for me. But then someone, like, Misfits came on a rotation of someone's mixtape in their car. I was like, now this is what I can handle this. I guess it was probably because it was a little more melodic than the other stuff.
I think also the Misfits crossed over to a lot of metalheads because of Cliff Burton, because he was such a huge fan. And, like, wore the Crimson Skull t-shirt all the time. So a lot of – that's not a –
You're probably right, because I think maybe besides where Eagles Dare, what probably clinched or cinched it for me for the Misfits was having the Garage Days Revisited album and Last Caress and Green Hell.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is amazing. I'm going to piss my parents off by listening to a song about raping babies and mothers and stuff like that. And we'd always
How
play.
Are you going to piss your parents off of that? They were singing these songs.
Well, Mom, I know you were talking about how dead babies are cool, but this one's about raping them. So there's that.
So take that, Mom.
Right. Did you, were your parents pretty loose when it came to music? Were they?
Oh, hell no.
No?
My mom, I remember, this is a great story. My mom confiscated my Suicidal Tendencies cassette she asked me, I went to the import section at the record store at the mall and purchased a Suicidal Tendencies cassette tape. And my mom asked me what I bought, and I showed it to her. I was really proud of myself. And she was terrified that it was going to result in me committing suicide. So she snuck into my room and confiscated that tape. So my mom was pretty square when it came to punk rock. She's a great lady. She's totally weirdo vegan animal rights activist now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but back then, yeah.
That reminds me of the Patton Oswalt comedy bit when he does the, if you want to have kids that grow up to be cool, you have to be square parents. You cannot, you have to, like, listen to the same Phil Collins album over and over again, and you cannot have any kind of, which I love Phil Collins. I'm not going to pretend like I don't. But you couldn't have any kind of fun with your kids. You have to just be a square so they grow up to be artists and cool.
How else are they going to rebel?
Well, I'm imagining, like I've said before, I think my kid will probably...
By listening to Phil Collins.
I think my kid is going to wind up either being a sports fan or, the most horrible of things, a Christian.
I worry that mine's going to end up and be like a hardcore Republican and like ruin Thanksgiving forever. Because I won't even have him on my side anymore. I'll be my entire family and my son. And I'll just have to sit at the kids' table by myself.
Mine would be to be like, Dad, can I talk to you about something? Yeah. Have you thought about Jesus? Then, you're out. Get out. The first kid thrown out of a house for being religious. Probably not. I'm sure I wouldn't be the only person who's ever done that.
Daddy, I got you this copy of Watchtower from the nice people on the sidewalk. Will you read it to me before bedtime?
Possibly the worst thing to ever read to him before bedtime would be the Bible, just for the...
Just read Revelations to him. Oh,
right.
My God.
Scare the shit out of him for life, because that's what it's supposed to do. my parents, I got the Gwar Scumdogs of the Universe album. A CD from a friend whose mom made him get rid of it because she thought it was satanic, and I was like, "Well, I'll take it. I like it. It's great." And then I remember sitting on my desk in my room, my mom walking in, and going, "Huh? what is this? I was like, oh, it's just like Kiss, Mom. They just dress up and do this kind of stuff. Oh, okay. That was about the extent of her care of my music and musical tastes.
I always had this funny thing about parents and music, and that, you know, whatever you're listening to, if you're into metal or into punk or whatever, there's always that one part of the song where everybody's just kind of freaking out and it just sounds like complete noise. But it's just that one part of the song. And inevitably, that's always the moment when Mom or a square person would walk into the room, leading them to the assumption that that's what you were listening to all the time, just the like freak out noisy part. You're like, no, no, it's not like that all the time. It's actually good music, you know.
You missed the 3 minute acoustic opening to this where it was just like, you know, they were doing arpeggios up and down the neck. It was amazing. Yeah, I think a comparable thing to that nowadays would be the trying to show someone a YouTube video. And, you know, we're like, oh, wait, it's getting to the good part. Wait, wait. Because, you know, inevitably when you're trying to get someone to listen to a song you like, it's never, the look on their face is never what you're hoping it's going to be as they're listening to it.
The YouTube thing that's the most annoying is when you're trying to show somebody a video that's gotten popular and there's like 20 different remixes or like parodies of the video you're trying to find, and it takes you forever to track down the one.
And even worse is the reaction video to that video.
Oh, God.
Oh, jeez.
Grandma watches Charlie the Unicorn for the first time. She's kid, so confused.
Kid shows Mom Two Girls, One Cup.
True story. We showed my grandmother Two Girls, One Cup.
Like, nice.
But, like, I come from a really...
On purpose?
Yeah, well, okay, so I have... Okay, let me preface it by saying I come from a family that did not block any music or television channels, clearly, but...
Well, hang on now. Before you go any further, it's because you couldn't get them in the mountains.
No.
There's a difference between blocking and not having access to...
No, we were... Growing up, we were like...
They had a satellite.
No, we were one of the few people, like, we had MTV and HB and all that stuff, and so, like, my house was always, like, the cool place to go to because my parents were like... Oh, what's that movie? It's rated R. Oh, well, is there sex? No. Okay. And they just trusted me. Like, I would somehow magically know that these movies I had not yet seen had zero sex. But they just, you know, so I had, anyway, so we're a weird family. But several years ago, I was at home, and I have a sister 2 years younger than me, and I had just recently seen Two Girls, One Cup, and I was like, hey, Kristen, I've got something for you. So I showed it to her, and we were upstairs, like, screaming in that high-pitched tone that you do when two or more girls are gathered. And my dad came upstairs, and he was like, what the hell are y'all doing? And so we were like, well, do you really want to know? Because at this point, he was still scared of the internet. And we were like, this is just part of what you can find on here, Dad. So then we showed it to my dad. So we watched it with my dad then.
Not the tip of the iceberg, but the turtle head of the iceberg.
Well, see, my dad, who has, like, a very weak stomach, was like... Oh, God. Oh, God, Lona. Oh, my God. Why would you show this? At which point my grandmother heard him yelling at us and had to come upstairs and investigate for herself.
Oh,
and she was like, girls, this can't be real. No one would really do this. And, like, she made us show it to her, like, two times. And we just sat up there. And it was, like, this really, really sweet moment for my family. Where we all got together and we learned the internet.
The time we bonded over Two Girls, One Cup.
Hey, you know, whatever it takes. It's one of those moments that I'll remember forever.
And now all of us will, too.
Right? Yeah. And my mom, when she listens to this. So sorry, Mom. Dad took care of us the rest of the time when he was
with us. What was the, what was your first horror film, Alex?
Oh, God. Probably Alien, I think.
Right.
It scared the shit out of me. I was really young. It was in its probably not its first theatrical run, but probably by the time it had gone to the dollar movies, because that's when my dad would take us to see movies.
Right.
So I can't remember what year. I was pretty young, and it was fucking scary as shit.
And that's the thing that I try to, like, I want to show my kid the scariest films, because I think about that. It's like, man, I was really young when I started watching these horror films, and I would say I turned out. Look at how I turned out. I turned out fine, but it's probably not a good measure of how people are. But no, it's definitely been a huge influence on my life. What about you, Drew? What about you?
I mean, I didn't actually watch a lot when I was a kid. The ones that always stick with me is as far as I can think of is or Something Wicked This Way Comes and Watcher in the Woods. I saw the kids horror when I was younger. I unlike you guys who got to just do whatever, I did have a lot of
but in fairness, Something Wicked is an incredibly good movie.
Yeah, and Watcher in the Woods is even pretty scary too.
They terrified me.
And I saw an article online. It was when Disney would scare the shit out of kids or something like that. Yeah. Was the article. It was like The Watcher in the Woods, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and there was one more on there, and I was like, oh god, I haven't seen these in forever.
Hocus Pocus.
No.
The witch. Well, the witches. Was the witches Disney?
Witches, man.
But it's still beyond those, though. I mean, I don't know what else they would have had on there. That's interesting.
Well, I guess the Escape from Witch Mountain.
I used to like those, though. Yeah, but they weren't really scary, but they could have been on there.
The Apple Dumpling Gang?
That was frightening, yeah. Their sequel, When They Rode Again, even more horrifying.
Savannah Smiles.
I loved all those movies, actually. These are some of my favorites.
I loved the Doberman Gang when I was a kid.
Oh, my gosh, the Doberman Gang.
Which one was Barney Fife in? Was that the Apple Dumpling?
He was in the Apple Dumpling.
Okay. Yeah. I remember that. I remember him. So, Lona, was your first scary movie, Two Girls, One Cup, with your grandmother?
See, I considered it more of a romantic comedy. No, it wasn't. I was trying to remember. We only had like a 2-screen theater, so our actual going to the
When she says that, she literally theater. Means in her house.
Right.
It was a great house. I remember my dad used to go to this little crappy video store, and he would always bring home lots of like the old stuff. Like I remember, House on Haunted Hill and The Blob and Night of the Living Dead, like the things that I want to show Noah now, but I can't get him to really watch because they're not in color.
And they're boring to kids now. That's the problem.
But
they
that's
are.
The thing. They weren't boring to me, though.
No, they weren't to me, but they are to kids. I mean, that's what's
well,
difficult
our kids
about
should be better.
This. Yeah.
The one I can remember distinctly, I'm sure I'd seen some that, I watched Watcher in the Woods and stuff like that, but it was probably the one that sticks out mostly in my mind was the Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one. I remember some friends getting the videotape. They had their parents were very well off, so they actually had bought a videotape of Nightmare on Elm Street whenever it came out. And just remember being like, Jesus Christ, this film is scary. And I watched it at home, and my sister convinced me that she wouldn't tell my mom and dad that she watched it.
I saw that in my science class in high school. The teacher brought that in for like a movie day, like a reward day.
Jesus.
And they brought that movie, and the kids went crazy. We loved it. It was in biology class.
Did anybody tell their parents? How many teachers were fired that day?
I don't know. The teacher never
day.
Got in trouble. I mean, this was in the 80s, so.
It didn't matter then. That's the thing. No one cared what you did in a classroom at that point.
Right. Adults could screw with kids more then. You
kinda,
know, you,
yeah, yeah.
You know, like even, I was just, you talking about these movies, I was thinking, I remember having a Halloween party and we were in a Candyman. And there was one girl there who was like absolutely terrified of it. And so my dad went into the bathroom and took a bar of soap and wrote Candyman is here on the mirror and just left. And so, of course, Teardrop Sad Girl went in there and she freaked out so much that she called 911.
Nice.
Wow. And the problem was, I just distinctly remember my dad just standing in the corner, just like laughing his ass off at this like 12-year-old girl who was just like just in hysterics. And you couldn't do that as an adult now to someone else's kid.
I
really couldn't.
I would like to, but I
couldn't.
I remember when my sister got so scared by Nightmare on Elm Street that I was grounded for a long time. I remember getting the Freddy glove and waiting for her to have a sleepover and hiding under the bed. And of course, as soon as they all got in the room and everything was quiet, I was like, I waited for like a good hour. I really committed to this too, popping out with the Freddy glove, and they all, you know, all crying, screaming. Man, it was a good youth.
Speaking of film scores, that's a really great one.
Yes.
Also.
And then would later be done by Brian May of Queen. That's not true. There's a Brian May actually composed, I think it's Nightmare on Elm Street 3, but it's not the same Brian May. It's not the same Brian May. Until the internet came around, I didn't know because nobody was ever able to tell me that. Whenever I saw it come up on the credits, I was like, Brian May from Queen.
You did have a lot of those guys turning to scoring movies after a while there. Like, you know, all of the Police, it seemed.
Well, right. Flash Gordon was, I mean, you know.
That was yeah. Queen.
Speaking of which, Lona, you girls at that age probably didn't realize what an awesome score Candyman had as well.
Us girls, like a group of men at that age, or little boys, would have been like, ah, this is fantastic.
Were you, I mean, I was just referring directly to you and the girls that you're watching with.
I don't know, a group of boys, you girls.
I would have said.
If I'd been watching it with a group of boys, we wouldn't have been watching the movie at that age, if you know what I mean.
I can see it. My brother didn't realize that, too, as he was being scared shitless when he watched it. I still remember that. After he and his friend watched Candyman, and they were freaked out.
So, just so you know, Brian May that scored Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy's Dead, he also scored Mad Max and Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior.
Nice.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And the film Patrick, which is by, who does Patrick?
The original one?
Yeah. The 78 version was...
Richard. I'm guessing this is an Australian composer.
Looks like it, yes. You can kind of tell in Freddy's Dead it has that accent to his compositions.
The music has that.
The music has the accent, yes.
It's got those vowels.
Right. And everything he scores can kill you.
Oh, clever.
I don't remember when I started. I don't really remember when I started like picking up that soundtrack. Actually, I think the soundtrack that got me that was the one that was like, I should, you know, I'm going to pay more attention to soundtracks or scores in films. I'm trying to think right now, but the one that keeps popping my mind is Meet Joe Black, Thomas Newman, but I know there was some before that. But I just remember.
I was going to say, it was high school, and it was Halloween was the big one.
Yeah.
That probably was the big turnaround. You know, I actually went out and bought one and things like that. Although as a kid, I had the Beetlejuice soundtrack. I remember when my cousin went and bought Appetite for Destruction, and I was getting the Beetlejuice soundtrack at that point.
Nerd alert. You're right. Danny Elfman.
Star Wars was a big phenomenon because they did like the disco album and all the spin-offs of that music.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
From my childhood.
Yeah, Star Wars may have been probably one of the first scores I ever bought because it was such a important part of those films, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was front and center. It became another character, almost.
Yeah.
Even Indiana Jones. I mean, John Williams probably scored my childhood.
Yeah, I mean he's the fucking man. I mean that's you know he's
I'm still
he's the high standard.
Yeah, like how he can still turn out original stuff.
Well, because he's a technician. He's the guy's just a master.
Right.
He actually overwrites. He's such an incredible composer that if you listen to like Jurassic Park, like the music gets turned so low because he's writing these really busy, really like opulent pieces of music under dialogue. So they have to mix it really low. So it's like there's like magnificent music that is buried, you know, because it's just too much. He's just that amazing, like that prolific. But, you know, I don't really subscribe to the John Williams school.
No,
I'm a more of a less is more. He's very, there's a lot of ornamentation in his writing, which is beautiful, and I have a lot of nostalgia for. But I tend to really like stuff that's more minimalist.
Right. I think
I agree with you there, yeah.
Yeah. Going back to Thomas Newman, I think was the, I remember like listening to his scores and thinking, what is it about his scores that are appealing to me? And apparently, I'm going to show my ignorance when it comes to music theory and all those vocabulary that comes to that was, he uses a lot of something called dissonance.
Yeah.
So I guess that was what was making me so, was appealing to me so much in his scores that I was like, what is
he's
it about?
He's a really creative composer. He tries a lot of different things that are, he's very unconventional. American Beauty is a.
Yeah, American Beauty is amazing.
That's a really great score. Yeah, he's a badass.
Yeah, when I mentioned Meet Joe Black as the first soundtrack, a score that I really fell in love with, which is complete bullshit because that came out in like 1998. But that score was the one that got me hooked on him, and then I could pick out his scores for any soundtrack he did or any film he did. So,
talented family.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's like, what, four composers in that family?
Yeah, I think like together they, I mean, they would have the Oscar record for nominations, which is not surprising.
John Williams may have him beat alone.
Well, yeah, but I mean, as far as, yeah, that's true.
Musical families, though, you're right.
Yeah, but as far as musical families.
You think does John Williams have any kids, and are they just completely hate music? Like, we get it, Dad. We get it. It's no, you know, this is great, but it's no Jaws.
They're all like performance artists.
Right.
Just do with no sound.
Right. They can't have music interrupt their lives. All our lives, it's been music. What do you think makes metal and horror kind of can exist together? What appeals to metal and horror fans, or metal fans and horror fans, that make it such a great mix? It's always been something I've wondered myself. I mean, I'm a huge metal fan and horror fan, but it seems like you can't have one without the other anymore.
I'm not a huge, I like a lot of metal bands, and I was really into metal when I was younger, but I'm not.
You don't really keep up with the new
metal
stuff?
I'm not a metal guy. I'm not a current metal guy so much. But, I mean, the short answer is it's, you know, it's dark subject matter. It's, you know, it's
right.
Kind of playing around with and the imagery in metal has always been like skulls and dark, you know, death-related stuff.
Right. See, I don't take that from horror. I usually take brightness and happiness away from horror. It's always a same with metal. No. No, that's a good point. It's a I've just always noticed that whenever it's a horror film, nobody ever puts in, what? I take that back. We've already mentioned Master P and Scream. So, obviously.
Well, Last House on the Left. I mean, a lot of times, I mean, it's,
yeah.
It's the juxtaposition, the idiosyncrasy of some of these soundtracks that also becomes, you know, that is part of the strength when you do that, though. I mean, that's the thing. It makes it stand out and makes it, you know, different at that point.
Like even the little La 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 thing in Rosemary's Baby with the harpsichords, yeah, and everything, like that's not a dark, twisted sound thing, but it's just unsettling because you have that noise that you would generally make to a baby that you consider comforting, yeah, and it's
that's
pretty much the
thing.
Opposite of it.
Like like lullaby stuff, like any kind of nursery music, you know, like child-like music is really evokes... people are terrified of being parents, you know.
Yes.
Parenthood it's scary, and so I think it just taps into a really like, or being a parent is, you know, you're terrified for your children's safety or whatever. So it really taps into that.
You're making something innocent sinister, which is basically what parenthood is. So
and the well, even the nursery rhyme in Nightmare on Elm Street, the 1-2, Freddy's coming for you.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Drew, have you started singing that to your child yet?
Not yet. He doesn't really need that yet.
I find that if all
next week,
I find that if I sing it happily, like nobody notices. But if I get like really like just that 1-2, Jackson immediately will say, "Stop, Jackson is my kid. Stop it." I'm not scared of horror films. 1-2, stop.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, I called Noah walking down the hall, and he was singing the song from Halloween, and I was like, what are you doing? And he had no clue. Like, I guess he had heard me watching it or something and picked it up.
Silver Shamrock or the theme song?
the theme song. But you know, and he didn't find it scary at all until I told him what it was. And then of course I would start singing it, and where he'd been singing it, it was fine, but like I get up behind him and start, and I mean, like, it would just he would get so upset. So, you know, I probably should make him watch that.
Did he sound like that version? Because I'd like to think that was the version he sounds like.
he actually did have a gruffer voice than he does now. He's going in reverse puberty, but but no, it wasn't quite like that.
Did when you saw Goblin, did the group Secret Chiefs 3 open up for him?
No, it was a band from here. God, that an old friend of mine is in that are awesome, and I'm blanking on their name.
You know who I really like out of Austin is American Sharks.
I'm not familiar with them.
They opened up for Gwar, they were a very... Every time I've seen Gwar, they have had the worst opening bands ever. I mean, nothing is as bad as when I saw Faith No More and Limp Bizkit opened up for them. But most of Guar's opening bands have been pretty crappy. And American Sharks came on, and I was like, well, actually, this time it was American Sharks and Pepper Keenan's band. Corrosion of Conformity opened up for him this time. It was an amazing, like, two opening acts. But, yeah. But Secret Chiefs did their version of Halloween. Like, the whole time they were opening, we thought they're going to have to do a Halloween song. I mean, they don't have to do the version of Halloween. It sounds, their music sounds like it could be a John Carpenter, like a metal version of John Carpenter stuff. And they did. They delivered. Have you seen Horsehead?
I haven't. It was at Fantastic Fest, and it was one of the ones that I wanted to see that I couldn't get a...
Well, yeah, we did it. Lona and I did that one last week, so...
Yeah, I heard it.
It was good. It was okay. I'm not going to say great. It was okay. It was fine.
The episode or the movie?
Both. Will you be a fan?
I was told the episode was a huge disappointment.
By who?
Found it. It's pinkish black.
Pinkish black.
From Brian.
Oh.
It's underperformed as an episode. Pinkish black. I'm putting them down. I'll put them in our show notes so people can look them up too.
That's who opened for Goblin, and they're really, really great band.
We keep going back to Goblin, and we keep mentioning, you know, obviously the big ones, you know, mentioning Deep Red and all. But I still love Phenomena more than any of theirs. And talking about mixing in metal, that makes no sense at times. Like he throws in Motorhead at one point. It makes absolutely no sense. I mean, he just keeps on. It's like Argento was trying to make an American horror movie, and it's like, oh, this is how we make it. And he throws in a metal song here and a monkey with a razor blade there and a... You know, something
changed
in the basement here, and then she controls bugs. It's like, no, that's not how an American horror film at all, but it's awesome. And that's one of my favorite scores by them, too. Or I love the video that you get, because I got the special edition VHS at one point, and it has the video where Claudio is like behind a waterfall, and you have the girl who's singing her, you know, very haunting melody over his keyboard. Fantastic video.
Does he have like the
Jennifer
double?
Connelly's running through a house.
Does he have like the double keyboard set up too?
Probably
the triple keyboard.
I would guess.
Will you beat a Fantastic Fest this year?
Yeah, being in Austin, I go every year.
Yeah, well, I will see you there then.
Awesome.
Yeah, then that will be before the Frightening Ass Film Fest when we bring you out. So.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, if you don't know, we will also be bringing Alex out for Frightening Ass Film Festival in Chattanooga this year. So. If you've listened this far and we haven't bored the shit out of you, then by all means, come out to that, too. Will this be a Spectrostatic's first live show?
I'm kind of thinking we might do a warm-up one before then.
Oh, then never mind.
Yeah. Oh, no? I can make, you know, I can keep it. I kind of wanted to work the kinks out ahead of time. So that it ran more smoothly.
I'm kidding, of course. No, I was very bummed that I couldn't work out the film festival this year, but... was it time and tide worked against me? So, what do you when you go to Fantastic Fest? Do you try to see everything, or do you kind of like make sure you? I know you can't see everything because I hear it's pretty hard.
I mean, last year I kind of was the first year I started burning out a little bit. I was, you know, you could do five movies a day if you wanted, and man, I did two 5-movie days. And then dropped down to like 3 movies a couple days because I was just like, ugh. It was really, you know, they start blurring together when you see too many of them. In the past, I've done 5-movie days pretty consistently.
I unfortunately am never able to watch films at my film fest. So,
yeah.
It's but Lona comes. She watches 5 movies a day sometimes. So, You saw It Follows at the film.
Yeah,
film fest,
I saw
right?
it at Fantastic.
You
fest,
did,
yeah, and as Cub as well.
God, why is it taking so long for Cub? I think Cub comes out like in the next couple weeks on VOD. I keep thinking every time I see the cover for Weir, I think, oh, Cub's out, and then it's not Cub because it's Weir, of course. But no, that's definitely on my list. I like to see that, and especially with the soundtrack you described, I'm definitely gonna have to.
Oh yeah, both are awesome.
All right, guys, I think we've. Anything else we want to talk about before I start fading this out? Well, we don't have to be silent while I do this. We can talk.
Well,
about
I just didn't know if you were giving us more directions that we needed. So
I know you're gonna have to. Without Tyler here, I do notice it's a little stilted because he does talk an awful lot, and I find myself having to feel the need.
I think it's really unfortunate and probably something that we should address that he can't lay down and speak at the same time.
Really?
That's what I wondered too. I was like, all it takes is a microphone being held up to your face. You don't really have to do much. But, you know, that's just me. I mean, I worked for 2 weeks with back pain and I was fine. All right, guys. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Please excuse my awkwardness. Thank you, Alex, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, and make sure you pick up Alex's both of his projects, the Hex Dispensers and Spectrostatic. Give them the Bandcamp site so they can go check them out.
TheHexDispensers.com for the Hex Dispensers. That's the punk rock band. And Spectrostatic.bandcamp.com for my solo filmic instrumental.
And it is definitely worth it. Spectrostatic's Escape from Witchopolis.
Witchtropolis.
Damn it.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's fantastic. I love it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it is very good. It is the best horror soundtrack you'll probably hear this year. That's not in a horror film, which it should be.
Some of it actually is now.
Yeah, that's right. Go check out Interior if you haven't seen that. I just
finished a short film that uses a lot of stuff from it.
Will we be seeing that in any of the film festivals here soon?
I sure hope so.
Awesome. Well, that's awesome. So, yeah, go check out his websites. You can find us on Twitter at HorriblePCast. That's HorriblePCast. Thanks for listening, guys. We will see you soon. Night. Bye. Whatever. Jesus Christ.
Bye. I'm Drew. Bye.
I'm Brian. And Lona is laughing at us because we're ridiculous. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
It's true.